Hey everybody, this is DJ Q for the Golf News Met Radio Network. We now return you to Jay's Place, already in progress.
Here, okay, you're English, and you spent a lot of time in England, so you must know a lot about English television, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you're familiar with Doctor Who?
Yeah.
Okay, do you like Doctor Who at all?
I watched it a lot when I was a kid. I don't know if it anymore,
good.
But Tom Baker was the doctor in my day, and yeah, I watched a lot.
Okay, well, then you'll remember this, all right? Shortly after Tom Baker, there was a tall, skinny, blonde guy named Peter Davison. And during his time was when the 20th anniversary of the show came out. Now, everybody listening, here's something fascinating about British TV in that time period. They didn't have reruns. Once it aired, if you missed it, so long, goodbye, and farewell. That was the end of it, okay? And when Day of the Daleks premiered, and only, you know, 11 million people got to see it, but everybody else that missed out was like, you know, they wanted to go all Oedipus and like stick pins in their eyes. They were so upset, like, that'd be the Day of the Daleks, okay? And it became the biggest thing. People were paying 200 American dollars, whatever that would equate to in British pounds, for like terrible VHS copies of Day of the Daleks. They could say that they saw it, you know. But anyway, getting back to brass tacks, what Doctor Who and the BBC decided to do for the 20th anniversary is they did one of those, you know, shows where all the doctors get together and will help each other out, okay? It was called The Five Doctors. But in anticipation of leading up to The Five Doctors, they were going to do one story from each of the previous four doctors. For example, the first doctor, they chose the original story, the very first one, called An Unearthly Child. For the Tom Baker era, they chose Genesis of the Daleks, you know, one of the great six-part stories. It's also the origin story, The Greatest Enemies. The third doctor, they did Planet of the Spiders, which was his swan song. But for the second doctor, okay, with all of these great stories, they chose, wait for it, The Crotons. This terrible story about these cardboard box robots, okay, with stupid, terrible voices. We will carry our doctor. I mean, it was just pitiful. And all of England was going, The Crotons? What? The Crotons? Why is she just the Crotons? Why not Tomb of the Cybermen? Okay. That's how I feel right now. That's how Atlantic City, Tony, you gave us the Crotons.
Yeah, that's just about the weirdest analogy I've ever come across. But I kind of get it. So let me ask the question. Here's why. Obviously, Atlantic City, as we know, is where the term birdie originated. And I've read the story a number of times, in reading it, I've noticed there's a number of differences between the stories that I've read. So I really delved deep into how the story of the term birdie came about. And the more I read, the fuzzier it got. You know, the more differences in the reports I heard. And you know, it was what we do know. It was, you know, these bunch of Philadelphia golfers, Tillinghast and Crump, and the names escape me at the moment. But you know that lot. And they would take a train down from Philadelphia to Atlantic City when it was snowy in Philadelphia on the coast. It didn't snow and it wasn't quite as cold, so they would go down to Atlantic City to play some golf, and they you know would play at Atlantic City Country Club, and they would play what they called a balsam. I assume that was, you know, they went out and probably played sixsome or whatever, or sevensome, eightsome, but they would you know, they would have little skins games, you know, a dollar a hole or whatever. And on one of these holes, and this is where it gets really fuzzy, we don't actually know which hole it was, and the hole itself that they played, where the term was coined, I'm not sure it exists anymore, but the green does. So at the club now, there's a plaque which says, you know, this is the hole where the term birdie was first used. But the green where actually the birdie, or it wasn't the birdie at the time, but you know, the birdie was made, is still there. But the hole that they played isn't the hole that it is now. And it's fuzzy about how many people were actually in the group. Tillinghast apparently was in the group, but some reports say he wasn't. Some people say George Crump was in the group. Some people say it wasn't. He wasn't. But we do know that what's his name? Abner Smith, who made the birdie, when he held the putt, when he hit the shot that led to this one under par, said, oh, that was a bird of a shot. And at the time, if you call something a bird, it was meant as a term of endearment or, a term of quality. It was something that was really good. So he said that was a bird of a shot. And later on, I'm assuming over wine or whiskey or whatever, they talked about it. And said, well, that resulted in a one under par. Let's call that a birdie because that was he used the term bird. And it wasn't long before, that had spread, that term had spread. And of course, we all use it now. I don't use it because I never make one. But,
out of curiosity, have you played with our dear friend Jeff Shelley yet?
I've played a couple of times with Jeff, and it's an interesting experience.
Okay, why?
Because he's very clearly a capable golfer. He has a decent enough swing. But one time, the first time I played with him was, I believe it was somewhere in Mississippi. And we came to, he found the first few greens in regulation, so I hadn't seen him chip. And we got to, I suppose it was the fifth or sixth hole maybe, and he missed the green, and he had a chip. And it was the first time in my experience I'd ever seen anyone, I'd seen it on TV, obviously with Langer when he was putting and various other people. But it was the first time I'd actually been playing with anyone who, and I saw the yips. And he didn't have the putting yips. He putted quite nicely, actually. He was anchoring at the time, and he putted quite nicely. But he had the chipping yips, and I've never in my life seen anything like it. And it just freaked me out. And after a couple of times, after a couple of instances of this happening, I just said, don't watch. Do not watch this man chip, because it's a freak show. And it was, if I can describe it, his chipping stroke, he might have a 40-yard chip, but the backswing would be less than a foot long, and he would try and whack it, and it would follow through almost like a full swing. It was just jerky, and it was so unrhythmical, and I felt so sorry for Jeff, because obviously this part of the game, it was just something he couldn't do. He just couldn't stop himself from doing it. I think we were playing with a pro, and he took him off to the side of the green and gave him a few pointers, and he just couldn't stop. Just couldn't do it. It was frightening.
Well, happily, that's the kind of thing with a lot of practice, everybody. The quickest way to shave 5 strokes off your game is to spend a couple of days on the practice, on the practice green putting and at the practice area pitching and chipping. Okay, especially if you're a young, beginning golfer or a high handicapper. That's the fastest way to shave 5 strokes is to work on your short game to, avoid that sort of thing.
I hope I haven't put the picture of someone yipping chip shots in their head, and they're scared every time they go miss a green.
Well, I doubt you're going to get in their heads, although, you never know, okay? I got in Padraig Harrington's head once pretty good with a question, and I wasn't even trying. We were at Southern Hills, okay, and we're all in a media scrum. And, you remember about Southern Hills in Oklahoma, but you remember it being ridiculously hot, blast furnace. And you also remember that they have the long, thick Bermuda rough. And it's very wiry. It's actually really not thick and juicy, but it's long and wiry. And the guys were like, oh, it's murder when you get in there. It's murder trying to get to the green. Well, he hit the ball in the rough off the tee 6 times, but he hit the green out of the rough 4 times. He was leading the tournament. So I said, just out of curiosity, I said, you missed 6 fairways, but 4 of those 6 times you hit the green, what's your secret? And this was, well, are you the stats guy or something? He didn't answer the question. So I just sort of swept it off, and the next day I'm sitting at my desk, and Brian Keogh, the Irish writer, and Dermot DeLeese, the other Irish writer, and Carl McGinty, the third Irish writer, come up, and they surround my chair. They're like, you got in Patrick's head. I'm like, what the hell are you talking about? They're like, Patrick mentioned you in his interview today. What are you talking about? Look. And Harrington, he apparently said something along the lines of, one of you guys got in my head asking me about how I hit the ball out of the onto the green, out of the rough. And I started thinking about it while I was playing, you know. So I saw him the next day, because that's what you do. You go back. You don't let the guy know that you got in his head. So I'm standing right in front of him, you know, dead on the rail, like a rail bird that I am. And he's answering another guy's question. It had something to do with a similar topic. He goes, yeah, ask my friend over here. Points at me and then turns, looks right at me and goes, hi. And then the worst possible thing for him happened, which is when Graham McDowell won the U.S. Open, I got to go out drinking with Graham and all the rest of the Irish writers afterwards. And Harrington's there, and his wife and I were sitting having a lovely conversation. So now he's stuck with me every time he sees me when we go down for the Grand Slam of golf when he made it. I popped up like an evil jack and thought, what are you doing here? And I responded, well, I'm wherever good times are had. So before I let you go, you're a European Tour correspondent, so tell us what's happening on the European Tour besides they're going to allow people to wear shorts in practice round.
Well, it's, as you know, it's the Abu Dhabi Championship this week, and I like these players. I think was it Stephen Bowditch who said after the President's Cup, you know, his off season this year or last year this time was a 12-hour flight from Korea back to wherever. That was really funny. And it's, you know, it's like you know, our off season, whether we're playing or whether we're watching golf, is that's just gotten so short. But I remember, you know, it was. A couple of nights ago, when I turned it on, you know, I really felt excited because it had been like it had been an enormous 2 or 3 weeks without seeing some proper live golf, you know, some really competitive proper golf on TV. So I turned on the Abu Dhabi Championship, and there was, you know, there's Fowler and McIlroy and Spieth playing together, and this is, you know, we're back in it. We're back in really serious golf, you know, in the run up to the Masters. It's just so cool. And I'll tell you one thing. I was on EuropeanTour.com last night looking at the leaderboard. And I saw something, and I thought, I hope I get the chance to talk about this with Jay tomorrow. Because this.
Oh, good.
This one.
I aim to please after all.
This thing that I saw, it disappoints me, it frightens me, but at the same time, I think it's really cool, not for him personally. But I noticed that, you know, on the European Tour leaderboards on EuropeanTour.com, they put, obviously, the Race to Dubai ranking. They also put their world ranking next to their name. And I saw some really interesting numbers. Trevor Immelman is now 1,505th in the world. Which, you know, when you consider it was only, what, seven, eight years ago that he won the Masters, that's incredible.
I'm not so sure, okay? In 8 years, that can be an eternity to a guy who's not dominant.
Well, with players these days, there's so many tournaments, and so many tournaments, you know, that have ranking points, you know, some of which probably shouldn't, and so many points are available. You know, this if you get in a slump and, you know, some of these guys, you know, there's this pile on, you're going to go down fast. But I didn't understand how another one, Mike Weir, is 745th. Now, you know, Mike Weir has not done terribly well the last few years, but how is Mike Weir 745th and Trevor Immelman 1,505th? Now, I suppose
how do you think?
it's an enormous gap. But I'm assuming, you know, once you get down to 745 and 1,505, you know, the actual difference in the numbers in the average score per point
is negligible.
But it wasn't those two. It was the one that really struck home, that I was really amazed by, is Matteo Manassero is 666, which I thought was quite interesting. I tweeted that I thought, you know, the connection was, you know, he he won four European tournaments, but by the time he was 20, one of which was the BMW PGA. And I just said he must have sold his soul, you know, to play that good, that young. There must be some connection going on there. And he's number 666, so that was quite interesting, I thought. But, you know, for a guy who got that good, that early, that young, to now, you know, to have dropped now to 666, I don't know the story behind it. I'm sure there is a really good story. If you could tell me, I'll be very interested. But what has happened to Matteo Manassero, and how long before he returns to greatness?
Well, there'll be something to talk about when we get back together again later this spring. And it's so great having you on the show. Before I let you go, tell everybody where they can read your stuff online.
A lot of places. Golf News Net, Golf Today Northwest, Pacific Northwest, links. One thing I didn't tell you about yet, I have the pleasure of November, I got an email from George Pepper asking me if I'd be interested in doing a story on the two biggest developers in golf at the moment, Mike Kaiser and Donald Trump. And I said, yeah, obviously the opportunity to write for Links is a great honor, and it's a wonderful thing to happen. But I don't know that much about Donald Trump other than what the internet tells me. And he says, oh, we'll sort you out with an interview. Don't worry. Here's his PA's phone number. So I got in touch with her, and we set up an interview. And obviously, you know, with everything that was going on at the time, they said 20 minutes, you know, and it's got to be, you know, 20 minutes, we'll just say whether he's in the middle of the answer or not. Sorry, that's it. We've got to go. So the following week, I phoned him and we got to speak. And after 20 minutes, I'm thinking, oh my goodness, I've asked him about a quarter of the questions that I want to. How am I going to get this done? But at no point did he say, we're done here. And at no point did one of his people interject and say, sorry, we have to go now. We spoke for an hour on the phone, and it just it made me realize, you know, for whatever you say about Donald Trump, you know, he really does love the game, and he really does love talking about it. And I was, we're not here to talk about politics, Jay, and I'm certainly not going to tell you my politics, but I will say that I'm not terribly in line with a lot of what Mr. Trump is saying, but talking to him about golf was fascinating, and it was very enjoyable. And you know, when you push away all the times when he wanted to tell me about his portfolio and how great his courses are, and all the, you know, the narcissistic stuff that, you know, when you push that aside, it was actually fascinating to talk to him.
Do you get the sense, though, that what he is doing in the golf world is intended to be for golf's betterment or for his own?
Oh, I think the initial push is for himself, but I think in some respects it has had a positive effect on the game, and just purely by the fact that it keeps it in the news. You know, he's not out there building municipal courses or public access courses, you know, that are $30 to play, and, you know, encouraging everyone to play golf. You know, he's come out and said, you know, that golf should be for the elite, and it should be something for everyone to aspire to. And he told me, he used his words, and I quote, he said, it shouldn't be for the lowest common denominator. And, you know, when you're on the phone and you're not in front of him, you can cringe without him coming back. And I cringe, and the hairs on my neck stood up, and I thought, oh my goodness, it wasn't a great part of the conversation. And I was curious because obviously he wants major championships, and you know, he's trying to, you know, get in bed with the USGA. And the USGA at the same time, you know, has done a great job in recent years of taking, you know, the US Open to public courses, and making it, you know, with their logo, you know, for the good of the game. I think they've done a good job with that. So I asked him how that sat with the USGA, him saying things like, golf is for the elite, and it should only be for people who, you know, he didn't use the word rich, but that's pretty, you know, it was obviously to read between the lines, that's what he meant. And the USGA is trying to take the game to the masses. So I asked, you know, how he thought that sat with the USGA. And he did pause for a moment, and, you know, there was a bit of bluster, and there was a bit of, they're fine. I think they're fine with it. And, you know, I really don't think they are fine with it, because it completely contradicts everything they're trying to do. It's a very difficult situation how you deal with Donald Trump. And it'll be, this isn't about politics. And, you know, if he does become president, inverted commas, blah, 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 if he becomes president, you know, what happens to him as a golf developer? I mean, these courses, you know, that could possibly host major championships are owned by the President of the United States. Is that scary or is that good? I don't know. I'm not sure.
Well, since we're almost out of time, we will have to pick this discussion up again at some time fairly soon. Where will people be able to read your interview?
This is going to be in Mint Magazine in the spring issue. I think it comes out, I believe, in April. But I will say this: up until that happened, I'll say this briefly. I'll try. Up until that happened, he said a number of things that, you know, were very contentious, you know, about the Mexicans and the wall and women. But he hadn't at that point. He hadn't said his bit about the Muslims and one or two other things, and he certainly hadn't gotten into a spat with Samuel Jackson and a few other things, and where he got personal with people. I thought, okay, so we all know where Donald Trump is politically, and that's not going to affect the article too much. But in literally every day for 2 weeks or 3 weeks after I spoke with him, he was, you know, the number one news story. And every day it was something that he said was just completely out of line, I thought, and completely controversial. And it changed changed the nature of the article a bit, because, you know, now people know more about Mr. Trump than they did before. You know, he's stretching the opinion, you know, people either love him or hate him, and that gap is getting even wider with everything he says, and it kind of changed the nature of the article a bit. So I'll be interested in the months that, you know, between the article, sending the article to the editor and it coming out, I'll be very interested to see, you know, what has happened to it and how it eventually comes out, because a lot has changed, you know, since we spoke in November.
Well, you can say that again. I mean, every day the situation just gets more and more interesting, to say the least. You know, it's an ancient Chinese curse. May you live in interesting times. I'll close with one final thought, which is this, is that, you know, I think I speak for every golfer when I say, every ardent golfer, when I say that I celebrate my victories on the golf course, I soothe my defeats on the golf course, I, you know, reconnect with my old friends on the golf course, I make new friends on the golf course. And as the game is a microcosm of life, it must be for everyone. Not just high, all people, high and low, or it doesn't serve its purpose at all. All right, well, we're going to have you back on at some time in the near future. Big thank you for coming on our show, everybody. I am Jay Flama. This is Tony Deer. You're listening to Jay's Plays on the Golf News Net Radio Network.
We're at the end of another great Jay's Play show, but thank you all so much for joining in. It's no fun doing this to an empty room, but it sure is fun doing it for all of you guys, so thanks so much. I want to thank Fish for kindly letting me use their great music as a theme song for the show. Thanks, guys. I want to thank CyberGolf and Golf News Network, cybergolf.com/writerscorner, including me and all the other fine writers, and thegolfnewsnet.com/radio. Take us home, DJ Q.
Tune in next time for another great Jay's Plays show on the Golf News Net Radio Network.
Thanks, guys. Catch y'all next time.